Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. And we're pleased to have back here on the program once again, Jim Kaler. He is Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, stops by here and we talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky at that time of the year. And of course, it changes
clouds,
all through the year.
Clouds.
Right at the moment is what you can see is clouds.
Pretty much clouds, yeah.
Well, sometimes you can see stuff in the sky, and winter can be a good time because often it is nice and clear, and it's cold. That's the other trade-off.
Part, right?
But we talk about what you can see if it's clear at this time of year and take questions about astronomy, and we're pleased to have him here once again, and we'll be doing that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Jim has written for a variety of publications, both popular and more professional. He was a consultant for Time Life Books on their Voyage Through the Universe series and has authored a number of books. Just to mention a few, The Little Book of Stars, The Greatest 100 Stars, and his latest is The Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars. And as you perhaps might guess, he's interested in stars.
Yeah, it's sort of a sort of a theme running through this, yeah.
I want to mention that he has just been awarded the American Astronomical Society's 2008 Education Prize, recognizing him for his outstanding contributions to the education of the public, students, and also the next generation of professional astronomers. So, congrats on that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's very nice.
You want to talk about what you can see, if provided that there's no clouds?
When the clouds clear, yeah. We're coming up to spring. The Milky Way is getting sort of out of the way. But you can see there's a lot of nice planets. The moon was beautiful this morning. You get up early in the next couple of days, you'll see it going through its crescent phase. And it's very pretty in sort of mid-twilight as it approaches the horizon. Venus has disappeared. It's awful tough to see right now near the horizon. But if you get up and admire the moon a little bit early before dawn lights the sky, you can see this bright beacon over in the southeast, which is Jupiter, which is coming up nicely. And if you got a pair of binoculars, even the cheapest optical equipment hold them steady on Jupiter, and you can see a couple of its satellites strung out to the side. It's pretty easy to do. In the evening, we got Mars, home of Elvis, I guess, he's supposed to be or something like that.
Really?
Anyway, no. But it's practically overhead. It's at pretty much its highest position. It's just a couple of degrees north of the summer solstice where the sun will be on the first day of summer. We'll get there eventually and marks it nicely for you. And it's a bright kind of an orangey red, depending upon how your eyes register color. It's a very pretty sight. And over to the east of that, you can find these two fairly bright stars kind of in a little row. The eastern one is – western one is Regulus and Leo, and the other one is Saturn. And again, if you've got an old telescope, you want to dig it out for, even with 40 power or so, you can start to see Saturn's rings. Very, very pretty sight.
Great. I hope everybody got a chance to see the lunar eclipse that we had just
recently.
That was nice. Because it was
nice.
Really beautiful.
Yeah, it was unusually so, I think. The moon passed south of the central part of the shadow, so it didn't go through the darkest part. It went through the brightest part of the total shadow. Because you get a lot of light scattered into the shadow from the Earth's atmosphere. So the shadow is not dark at all. And there was some interesting gradations in color and brightness across the lunar disk. A very, very attractive sight. We won't see another one for a few years now.
Yeah. That night I happened to hear on All Things Considered they were talking with someone, and I think it was someone from Sky and Telescope magazine who were just talking about it. And the thing that struck me is he said that the moon looks like a ball hanging in the sky. And so I went out and looked at it and I thought, darn it, it really does look like a ball hanging in the sky.
You just can't see the string, that's all.
And I guess it does indeed have to do with that shading that emphasizes the fact that it is in fact a sphere and not just a flat disk.
The color change and the brightness change across it give it a sense of three-dimensionality, right. which is very attractive. It was also in a nice setting. It was sort of in between the star Regulus and Saturn, so it had a pretty stellar setting in the background as well. It's one of the more attractive eclipses I've seen in a while.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Fortunately, it was clear. There weren't clouds.
Oh, it was a beautiful night. A little cold.
Got to dress up, but it was enough so that you can go out there and at least stand for a few minutes.
You walk back and forth. The whole thing takes a few hours to get over with. You know, just stand out there and stare at it. You go every 15 minutes, take a look and see what progress has been made.
Yeah, very good. Well, again, if people who are listening here have questions about astronomy, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and talk with our guest, Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy here at University of Illinois.
These eclipses are interesting, too. They're not scientifically important anymore, really, but amateurs will look at the darkened disk and hopefully maybe see a few meteorite impacts. That's happened on occasion. That's an interesting thing to do. And the circular outline of the shadow is the first real solid proof that the Earth was a sphere. So it's educationally, it's of considerable interest.
Yeah. And I guess when something like that happens and I look up in the sky, I do think a little bit about how that must have looked to our forebearers and what they must have thought.
Well, they knew it was the Earth's shadow.
So they actually didn't know why this was happening.
Yeah, yeah. It goes back a couple of thousand, over maybe 2,500 years to even attempts at measuring the distance of the moon from the Earth using the characteristics of the shadow. They're a pretty sophisticated bunch.
And, well, I know that the Greeks within they got quite close to being able to say how big the Earth was.
They knew the size of the Earth was known to within, we don't know how big their distance unit was very well, but within 10% or something like that. And the ratio of the size of the distance of the moon to the size of the Earth was known as well. So they knew the distance of the moon. And there were even attempts of making measurements of the distance of the sun. Turned out it couldn't be done by the technique that was applied, but the idea was ingenious. And at least they knew that the sun was considerably farther away than the moon.
Mm-hmm. And they understood that the deal was that here the Earth was getting in between the sun and the moon,
It doesn't take too much figuring out. You got a bright sun over here, you got a dark shadow over there. Hey, it's one's got to be connected with the other, because the origin of the phases was well known and well understood.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone on our line one. This is someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, Doctor. I'm sorry, but I missed out. I'm a novice at this. Just got a telescope for Christmas. Haven't been able to use it much because of the cold and the clouds. But could you go again and tell me where to find Saturn very quickly here, please?
Saturn is over in the east at sunset. When the sky darkens, it's fairly low in the east and then starts climbing up. It crosses the meridian to the south around midnight or so right now. And it's the brightest thing over there. So you just look for the brightest thing you can see. It'll be a star, fairly bright star to the right of it or up to the east of it. I keep getting mixed up. To the west of it. So you'll see this pair and then look for the easterly of the two, which would be the brighter, and that's Saturn. It's pretty easy to find because of its brightness. It's not overwhelmingly brilliant, but it's the brightest thing in that part of the sky.
And I'm glad to hear that it's going to be easy to find also.
Yeah, don't confuse it with Sirius, which is a bright star down to the south. That'll twinkle away like crazy. Saturn just sort of sits there and stares back at you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And how much of a telescope, how much power do you have to be able to see the
rings? I just had a great little 3 inches of kid. 80 power will show the rings very nicely. Not only can you see the rings, but you'll usually see a dim thing that looks like a star next to it, which is the biggest satellite, Titan. That's almost always visible.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I came across this item that I liked. This has to do with the fact that people have always come up with little ways of remembering the names of the planets of our solar system and in what order.
Yes, but I haven't the faintest idea of what they are since I just learned them in order.
Well, this is apparently now a National Geographic sponsored a contest for school kids to do this.
Yeah.
And the winner has just recently been announced. This is a girl who lives in Montana, a fourth grader at Riverview Elementary School. She came up with, "My very exciting magic carpet just sailed under 9 palace elephants." This was selected from about 800 other submissions. So that's how it is. We get Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Ceres, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, and Eris.
Oh, we got to get Eris
in order. We got to get them all in.
It's getting tough to define what is a planet and what isn't a planet. And, a planet is what you call a planet, and if you don't call it a planet, it's not. That's really the simplest way to do it. There really is no logical system that can divide one from another, unfortunately. Yeah. People have tried to do it, and it always kind of messes things up. So you have the classic eight planets, Mercury through Neptune. You want to stick Pluto on there, that's fine with me. It has it's been called a planet since 1930, and it behaves like a planet, sort of acts like a planet. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff out there. Eris is bigger than Pluto, but it's a lot farther away, and Pluto is sort of the classical transition object between the planets and this debris belt that's out beyond Neptune.
Mm. Now, see, my question about this, though, is Ceres?
Ceres is the largest asteroid, and when it was discovered in 1801, the discoverer, I think his name Manny Piazzi, called it a planet because it sort of fit the geometrical progression of the way things should have been. They were expecting a planet at that distance. And then after a few years, they found another one, then another one, then another one. There's about 100,000 of the critters known at this point, and you can't remember them all. So Ceres is the biggest one, but it's still small. It's only, I think, about a quarter of the size of the moon.
Oh, okay. I got the memo about the planet beyond Pluto.
But it's
Pluto,
nice, you know, it's nice to stick that one in there.
I'm not really sure what that was.
The asteroids are sort of a failed planet. If you rolled them all together, you'd have a little bitty planet. But apparently Jupiter was close enough to prevent all the accumulation of that debris, so we got stuck with a bunch of little stuff that's just grinding itself down now through successive collision.
All right. We got some other folks here to talk with. Let's do
okay.
that. And next is someone in Champaign. This will be line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It seems unlikely to me that the lunar orbit and the Earth's orbit are in the same plane, which causes there to be eclipses. And I'm wondering if it's always been that way and if it's always going to be that way, or we're just lucky right now. Thank you. I'll take my answer offline.
Most things are in the ecliptic plane. The dynamics of it seem to be pretty well understood. The moon is thought to have been created in a competing collision between two planets, a Mars-sized body that hit the Earth a few tens of millions of years after the Earth itself was created, and the debris formed the moon. This is about the only way you can explain the chemical composition of the moon, and the dynamicists say, yeah, they understand from the gravitational influences why the moon is in the plane of the Earth's orbit. That naturally gives you eclipses. The moon is tilted a little bit with respect to the Earth's orbital plane. That's why you don't get an eclipse every full moon. It usually goes above the shadow or below the shadow. And about twice a year you get the alignment and the moon plows right into the shadow. There's a curious thing happening, though. You get an eclipse of the sun for the same reason, of course. The moon gets in between us and the sun. You get into the shadow of the moon, and you get an eclipse of the sun. By coincidence, the angular size of the moon is half a degree. It's almost exactly the same as the angular size of the sun, so the fit is perfect, which is an artifact of our times because the moon raises tides on the Earth. That slows the Earth down, and that slowing goes into moving the moon farther away from the Earth at a rate of about an inch a year. So eventually the moon won't fit across the sun anymore and won't have any more solar eclipses, although the lunar eclipses will stay there. I can't remember. I figured out once how long it'll be, but it's millions of years before something like that will happen, but it's not a fancy. There are reflectors, mirrors on the moon, and you can measure the distance to the moon with lasers. And sure enough, the moon is moving farther away from the Earth pretty much as predicted.
Hmm.
I mean, it's nothing that you'd notice over a lifetime or anything. It's kind of about the same rate North America is moving away from Europe.
Okay. Hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's go on, and we'll talk next with someone in Gibson City. This is line two.
Yes, well, I am going to be in Santiago, Chile next week.
Ooh.
And it's
warm.
that too. I'm looking forward to that. But also, I was wondering what to look for in the sky. We are going to not always be in the city. So I was wondering if you could give me any clues of what to look for. I know the Southern Star.
Look for the Southern Cross.
Or Southern Cross.
Yeah, yeah. You can't miss it. You can see it from town even. It's bright. It's two first magnitude stars. And right behind it are Beta and Alpha Centauri, Alpha Centauri is the closest star to the Earth. So it looks like there's two bright stars chasing the Southern Cross across the sky. You look a little bit later in the evening and you'll see it. It's hard to miss. It's a four-star pattern. It's not it's almost looks like a box, really. Probably it's iconic of the Southern Hemisphere. It's almost impossible to miss. You look to the south and then look a little bit to the east first, and because it's quite high as seen from down there.
Well, I'm looking forward to doing that.
Then if you get a chance in the early morning hours when Sagittarius is up, and if you can get out into the country, really try to find a dark site. And in the early hours, say, guessing 3, 4 a.m. or something like that, just look overhead for the Milky Way, and it'll knock your eyes out. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's far brighter than anything you can see from here.
Well, I know that they stay up late in Chile, so we might even be able to do that.
Oh, yeah. try to catch the Milky Way. It'll bring tears to your eyes. It's really beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
You're
all
welcome.
Right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's now talk next with somebody here on a cell phone. They're on the road on I-72 here on our line 3. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This might be a question a little out of the ordinary, maybe not, and you can comment it as best you can. I have a buddy who's a commodity trader, and he studies the alignment of the planets and the sun and the moon and all that good stuff. And I was, I don't necessarily expect you to comment about the validity of that as a methodology. You can if you choose. But I am interested in knowing what we do know about the influence of the planets, the sun, moon, and what causes the effect it may or may not have on what happens here on Earth. And I'll take your call off air. Thank you.
All right.
You got to separate out the astrology of it. The so-called planetary influences, you know, Mars is in Gemini, and that'll do something to whatever, your dog or whatever, you know. From the real thing, the Earth is, in fact, influenced by the planets gravitationally. It's a very, very slow effect. The planets, planetary gravitational fields, each planet has got to affect the other. I mean, we're dominated by the sun, but the other planets in the solar system have an effect on us. And the slow effect is to slightly, over time, change the size of the Earth's orbit, in particular change the eccentricity or the shape of the Earth's orbit. And that coupled with the moon's effect on us, which causes a 26,000-year wobble in the Earth's axis, you put all these things together, and they've been blamed on bringing ice ages to the Earth. They call them Milankovitch cycles. It's very slow. And periodic. The Earth's orbit expands, contracts a little bit, and the eccentricity changes over a 46,000-year period, if I recall. And it's quite noticeable from near zero to considerably greater than it is today, and that can have an effect on climate. That's probably has nothing to do with current climate change or anything else. We're talking here about thousands of years over a very long period of time. But yes, indeed, there are influences, and they're very interesting, and they've been studied for a great many years.
Mm. But as far as you're concerned, the phases of the moon do not influence the commodity markets?
Apparently not. Unless you believe in that, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then it probably will. But the phases of the moon has a powerful effect on the Earth. It produces tides, and I suppose you could say tidal action could conceivably have an effect on offshore commodity. I don't know what I'm talking about here. But it does. It certainly has an effect at the coastline in terms of, you know, magical effects on a human being. It has. There's no effect whatsoever. The tides can't possibly affect a person that's only 6 feet high. It affects the oceans. It doesn't even affect the Great Lakes.
Is it not the case that some people make the argument that if we did not have the moon and did not have the tides, then we might not have life on Earth?
That has been brought up. The moon is thought to stabilize the obliquity of the tilt of the Earth's axis, which is 23.5 degrees. And that changes too. That changes over a long period. I don't remember the periodicity, but changes by about 1 or 2 degrees, which changes the positions of the Arctic Circle. It changes the position of the tropics. Right now, the tropics are shrinking because the obliquity is decreasing. These are measured effects. And these have to do with largely with lunar and solar effects. Planetary effects play a role too on the position of the Earth's orbit. They're long-term things. But if without the moon, I know there have been calculations made that suggest that the Earth's tilt, this 23.5-degree tilt, which is what's responsible for the seasons, could oscillate greatly. I've read that the Martian tilt, which is now about the same as ours, can get up as high as 40, 50 degrees. And that could have a devastating effect on life. I don't know if it would prevent it, but it certainly wouldn't do modern agriculture any good, that's for sure. Mm. It would have a powerful effect on it. So the moon seems to be a stabilizing influence. Without the moon, we would probably be a very different planet.
Yeah, all right. We'll talk next week.
That is a good question. These influences are real. They're just slow and long.
Right. Talk with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I hope I can ask a question about the Earth's rotation, because this question has been driving me beyond distraction. And that is, you go up to the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry, and they have a Foucault's pendulum.
Right.
You know, incredible thing. You know, several floors long, the string, and this ball's going back and forth. And then somehow the plane of that swinging rotates so that you can tell time by it.
Right.
Well, now I'm thinking, I'm standing in Chicago, the Earth is turning west to east, which ought to be just like kind of like a straight line up there. How do we get this circular movement?
Well, think of it, the best way to think of it is to put the Foucault pendulum at the North Pole.
That's where I thought it would work, and nowhere else.
No, it'll work everywhere except at the equator. At the North Pole, the pendulum's plane of the swing will rotate around in the clockwise direction over 24 hours because the Earth is just turning under it. That's all that happens. But if you go off the North Pole a little bit, what happens is that the alignments are not quite right and the period increases. By the time you get down to Chicago, the period is about 30-some hours or so instead of the 24 hours. And by the time you get to the equator, everything is lined up in the other direction and you don't notice it at all.
At
the South Pole, it would be in the other direction.
I see, because we're on a big sphere, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. They're a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun to watch. It's almost mesmerizing. You go to these museums, and they'll set them up with the pendulum hit little pegs or something, and people just stand there and watch until it knocks the next one down.
I just thought of a stupid joke. I want to get up there for when we change the daylight savings time. To
see yeah, it'll jump by an hour. Yeah. No, it won't do that.
Okay. No, you've explained it. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Thank you very much. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest this morning is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy here at University of Illinois, and every once in a while is here and we talk about astronomy and answer questions. He does. 333-9455, toll free.
Well, you could try it yourself.
I don't think so. See, I need to have somebody on the show who really, I can pretend to know stuff, but I need to have people here who actually do know stuff. That's the thing.
Or at least think they know stuff.
Good enough. Let's go on, and we'll talk to someone here in Belgium. Line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Would this be a place to ask a question about the Big Bang?
Sure.
Okay.
Don't know if I can answer it, but certainly can give it a shot.
Yeah, that's the same way as me. Now, as I understand it, things change from whatever they were very rapidly to whatever the beginnings of what we are now.
That's probably as good an explanation as I've heard.
Okay. Now, if that happened then, what's to keep it from happening again? Well, in other words, changing from what we are now to something totally different.
That's a good point. There have been people who have tried to figure out where the Big Bang originated and how it originated, and there are ideas that there could have been multiple Big Bangs elsewhere in the universe and that this could happen almost anywhere at any time. It hasn't because we're still here. And all we know of is that there was apparently one of them in which we are enmeshed and it's still going on. And the universe, the space-time of the universe in which we're trapped in a way, is expanding. And what caused it to start with is a mystery for all of the effort that's been put into it. All we know is that it happened, it started, and once you get it going, you can pretty well explain why we are what we are today. But the origin of it is not known.
Then the actual astronomical portion that was getting at about it is we wouldn't possibly be able to see it coming.
Well, that's probably true.
Because it'd be going so fast, we couldn't see.
I don't know. I don't know the resolution to that. All we know is what we see, and that's what science is about. And what we see is that there is a powerful expansion to the universe, that everything's moving away from us, and at speeds in direct proportion to distance, almost in direct proportion to distance. And the deviation is showing that the whole thing is accelerating and seems to be getting faster. As soon as we seem to understand, think we understand something about what's going on, there's another stunning discovery showing we don't. And it's boosted cosmology, the study of the universe at large, into the forefront of astronomy, the fascination of it all.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. To another caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello. Mm-hmm. I tuned in late, so you may have answered this, but when I was watching the lunar eclipse, it became very orange when it was starting to fill up, and I wondered what caused that.
It's the same thing that causes red sunsets. The shadow is not perfectly dark. You have both scattering of sunlight in the Earth's atmosphere and refraction through the Earth's atmosphere into the shadow. If you stood on the moon during the eclipse, you'd see a bright ring of light around the Earth, which is the Earth's atmosphere. And when the sun sets, of course, it turns a little bit reddish because the blue component of sunlight gets scattered out by the Earth's atmosphere, so the sun turns red. That's what causes the blue sky. So you're seeing an extreme version of that. As the sunlight goes through the Earth's atmosphere, all the blue and shortwave component gets scattered out, and about the only thing that gets through is the red, so the moon turns red.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It depends a lot upon the state of the Earth's atmosphere, too. If you've had recent volcanic eruptions, the moon can get very dark during eclipse. And we haven't had any for a while, so the moon was pretty bright this time.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, thank you. To me, it looks kind of like it's been kind of washed with coffee. It looks sort of sepia.
I've seen them so dark you can hardly see the moon at all.
Really?
And then so bright, like this one was bright. This was really easy to see. There's a considerable variation. It depends on cloud cover, too. The volcanic action, volcanoes launch dust and aerosols into the Earth's upper atmosphere, and that prevents the sunlight from getting through into the Earth's shadow.
Yeah, I'm really pleased I got a chance to see it.
I guess the Pinatubo eruption in
2010
the Philippines.
Really is dark. The next...
Yeah, that sounds about right, which isn't all that far away. We're in 2008.
Well, yeah, I guess that's right.
How time flies, right?
Exactly. Let's talk with another caller here. Someone here where we are, Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have to revisit the celestial and terrestrial question that was raised a bit ago because there's a book from 1978 by the late Paul Feyerabend, Swiss philosopher based out of Berkeley, when he wrote his books. He's a controversial figure, but he had a peculiar chapter called The Strange Case Against Astrology. He wasn't an advocate of astrology, but he was pointing out that 178 Nobel laureates signed something that blatantly said that, blankly said that there could be no connection between celestial and terrestrial events. And he decided to investigate it, and he found out that they weren't skeptical enough, which is that he cites some results from a biometeorological institute in Amsterdam or somewhere in the Netherlands, Wageningen or something, and points out that they, in a Gaussian box that's totally climate controlled, that they could predict the phase of the moon from the cell growth in potatoes. In the little eyes
of
potatoes.
Well, I have no knowledge of that.
Well, I'm just trying to say that I don't think you're skeptical enough. You can't assert something without evidence, and I think this guy marshals at least some kind of evidence to...
Then it would have to be replicatable everywhere else on Earth, and then other experiments would have
true.
To show the
that's
same
true.
Thing.
And
I don't know if they have.
I think they did it, actually. But the point being is that you can't deny that there's a connection just on the idea that, well...
That's absolutely true.
That's
what science
now,
again, is about.
His surmise, or their surmise in this institute, was that even though the gravitational effect of the moon is very, very small, it's enough to affect the tides, and that there's a summoning of this image of the human body and biological organisms as being so finely tuned that even a small change could affect something like the angle of the hydrogen bond in water, and that consequently that this was what they were in trying to scientifically and rationally discern and explain what they had seen, that they were and that may be grasping at straws, and that may not be the explanation, but that the point is that there's a lot of lore, and even hospitals schedule their major operations away from the full moon because they just know that there's more bleeding when the moon is full than when it isn't. So
I think a lot of that is anecdotal, and the full moon effect, for example, has been finally put to rest about more crime being taking place during the full moon. When you look at the full statistics, it just isn't any relation.
Well, I suggest that, you know, if you can tell the phase of the moon in a Gaussian box with total climate control, something is going on. And I think you're not being skeptical enough. I was raised a logical positivist myself, so I'm overcoming it. And I don't know what the case is, really.
Well,
I just think that it's quite easy to just anyway, that's not astronomy. But
no.
But I'll let you go on.
Okay, thanks. Strange things. There are lots that we don't understand. That's why there is a science. But it would seem to me that sort of thing, if one person proved it, everybody would be proving it, and it would jump out at you, and it would be big-time news, and it isn't.
Mm-hmm. We have time for other questions, and our guest is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy here at University of Illinois. Occasionally he's on the show, and that's what we talk about. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's something I want to ask you about that's star-related, a story that I came across. This is apparently, well, here I'll read this story. A young star is speeding away from the Milky Way so fast that astronomers have been puzzled by where it came from. Based on its young age, it has traveled too far to have come from our galaxy. Now, by analyzing its velocity, light intensity, and for the first time, its telltale elemental composition, some astronomers at Carnegie apparently have determined that it came from a neighboring galaxy, from the Large Magellanic Cloud. I read that and I thought, well, this is really interesting. I guess I understand everything is moving, but the idea that a star could be traveling that way, does this happen a lot?
Large Magellanic Cloud's about 150,000 or so light years away.
Uh-huh.
It kind of surprised me that it's a young star, but I suppose it's possible. Gravitational interactions can really give a kick to a star. There are some that have been measured going at hundreds of kilometers per second moving out of our galaxy. They can be tossed out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally said when you teach this stuff that, you know, all stars belong to galaxies, and certainly stars have to be born within the dense confines of galaxies. But they're finding, even in looking at other clusters of galaxies, that there are stars that can escape. And so there's a reasonable number, not a lot of them, but there's more than we expected in the spaces between the galaxies. So if one were ejected from the LMC toward us, it could just plow right into us. And this probably not too great a surprise when you start thinking of it. It's fascinating to see. We galaxies seem to have grown by collisions, and the Large Magellanic Cloud is being torn apart by the tides raised by our galaxy. You can even see a stream running behind it in the back along the other direction of its motion. And these streaming motions, well, some of it's eventually going to fall into us.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called Sagittarius dwarf galaxy right now is plowing right through us. It's in ours. It's colliding with ours. So this is it's been sort of revelatory over the last 20 years to watch the concepts develop that galaxies grew up by successive collisions as much as anything else.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I guess I had not known that something like that could happen, that a star not only could get kicked out of one galaxy but could be shooting across the universe.
There's a couple of mechanisms for doing that. If you have interactions between two double stars, for example, and they sort of collide with each other, you can break them apart and give them real kicks. And if you have a star in orbit about a massive star that blows up, these explosions seem to be off-center. So the massive star goes kicking away at high speed, and then the little guy goes off at even higher speed in the other direction. So there are a whole bunches of these so-called runaway stars in our general neighborhood, and you could accelerate one to probably to pretty high velocity enough to reach another galaxy.
Right.
Now, as long as you're confined within our own local group area.
Runaway stars.
Runaway stars are called, yeah.
Other callers, let's talk with them. Line one next is Champagne. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I'm, as we speak, sitting here looking over a Scientific American special report about parallel universes.
Ooh.
talk about that, if you would, a little bit, because
I got to admit ignorance. I have no idea. I suppose it would be – I don't think you could run from one to the other, you know, back would be a little funny. You know, you can't go from winter to summer that way. I think the idea is that – there are – I think parallel is probably a poor word here, that there are multiple universes. It's called a multiverse, actually. We live in a universe in which we are confined. We have no access to anything outside of it, but there exist others that are going on from in an infinite cosmic foam, so to speak, that have taken place – big bangs have taken place elsewhere, but we can't have any contact.
What I called about and I would like you to speculate on is – it's known that our universe is expanding.
That seems certainly to be the case.
And it's also thought that there doesn't appear to be enough matter in our universe to explain the expansion and so forth. But I've begun to wonder, could it be that one of the reasons, or perhaps a contributing factor to the expansion of our universe, is it's being tugged on from the outside by forces that we are currently ignorant of, or will probably perhaps even remain permanently ignorant of, but what do you think about
that? That doesn't sound right, but I can't comment on it. I'm not a cosmologist, and that's well beyond anything that I really understand. In terms of your other comment, the universe is expanding, and I think the proper way to put it is there doesn't seem to be enough matter to slow it down.
Yeah, that's
so it remains expanding. The other aspect of it is that there is some mysterious force that seems to be causing the expansion to accelerate, and you give it a name and it sounds like you're less ignorant about it. It's called dark energy, but nobody has any idea what it is.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
There's a lot that's not known out there. I mean, trouble is we don't know what it is because we don't know it. Now, there's a silly thing to say, isn't it?
Sounds positively Rumsfeldian there. We know there's known knowns, and then there's known unknowns, and then there's unknown knowns and unknown unknowns.
It's fascinating to watch it develop.
Yeah, is there evidence for or data that would lead one to propose multiple universes?
No.
So this is just. It's just a thought experiment.
Well,
it's
had to happen.
It's a
apparently happened
idea.
To ours, so maybe it would happen someplace else. There are mathematicians who delve into this, but it seems to be at this point outside the realm of observation.
Hmm.
So which is the essence of the science.
It just proceeds out of the question, well, why should we think that this is the only universe
and
there is?
It's certainly fair to develop theories because then even without the observation, because then they'll predict observations that maybe you can go out and make. So it's certainly fair to do so.
All right. Line number two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
This is merely an observation. It's nothing scientific at all, but I wonder if you could clarify it for me. It seems I'm a real watcher of the moon. And recently, since I've been wandering around more at night than I ever have before in my life, it is really beautiful when it sets. I had never noticed that before because I wasn't up at 3 or 4 o'clock. But it seems to me in the fall there is one month when the moon seems to be full for a longer period of time. And it's either October or November. Is that true? Is it just
It's really an illusion. The moon goes pretty steadily through its phases. There's some variations in timings, but there's nothing that would jump out at you with the eye. I think what you may be seeing is related to what's called the harvest moon effect, and this has to do with the path of the moon laying fairly close against the horizon. So you see a lot of near full moonlight early in the evening. That is the delay in This happens in September and October evenings near the time of the equinox, where the delay in moonrise from one night to the full moonrise, when it's close to full, is very short compared to the one day to the other. The delay from one day to the other is not very much. And you see a lot of what appears to be full moonlight. And you'd see the other effect 6 months later in the spring at moonset. I think this is probably what you're talking about. And in older times when you were harvesting by moonlight, this could be very important.
Yeah, I know this is called the harvest moon.
Yeah, yeah. They get what's called the hunter's moon in October, and it's pretty much the same kind of thing.
So it really is there longer, and I look forward to seeing these minute changes.
For a period of 3 or 4 days around full moon, it's kind of hard to tell whether you're looking at a full moon or near gibbous or whatever. It all looks pretty full. And then if you've got the delay in moonrise really short from one night to the next, it looks like you get a lot of full moonlight, whereas 6 months later at moonrise, moon disappears very fast after full moon.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
No one else seems to have noticed that, and I thought I was – maybe not observing the right thing.
No, it's great.
Good
great that you've worked on it yourself and got it yourself. Thanks.
Okay,
all right, thank you. Well, we certainly have time for other questions. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580.
That's a fascinating thing. The best thing about this business is that you can go out and look at this stuff for yourself. It's really hard to do nuclear physics at home in your basement. But, you know, you can do astronomy of any sort out in the backyard and discover things all by yourself. And isn't that great? I'm always finding things out. Just looking.
And if you want to go to the extent of actually having a telescope, you can. The equipment is not terribly expensive. So if you really wanted to
now
start
for a few hundred
that,
bucks, you can get a decent starter telescope, and it's just you can spend an evening just looking at the moon. There are a lot of moon maps available. I think they're probably available on the web, and just start looking at landforms on the moon. It's fascinating. Bright planets. Mars is kind of tough with a small telescope because it's not very big. And right now it's still kind of far away. But Jupiter is a lovely sight. You see cloud belts. You can see the satellites. Watch them go around the planet from one night to the next. Take a look at Saturn. Look at the rings. Watch Titan go around. Even if you've got decent sky, you might even see a couple other little satellites of Saturn. Look at the phases of Venus and then start poking around for double stars, the Orion Nebula. All these things are available to anybody out in the backyard.
Yeah, even in Champaign-Urbana, the sky's dark enough so that you can see those things.
Yeah, if you're in the middle of the campus, it's a little difficult. But we've got our 12-inch telescope sits right in the middle of as bright lights as you're ever going to want to see, and we can still see a number of decent sights.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I had a chance to talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the head guy of the planetarium in New York City and is well known for writing about and commenting about astronomy. And one of the stories that I read about him that I thought was really funny was he talks about when he was a kid and he grew up in, I think, in the Bronx or something like that. And when he went for his first visit to the planetarium that he now runs, he's sitting there and the lights come down and all these stars come out. And he said, wait a minute. What are you trying to pull here? I know what this guy looks like, it doesn't look like
you,
this.
You learn the sky from the city, and you get the few hundred brightest stars, and that's all you can see. And you learn constellation patterns, and you get out in the country, and you're lost, where there's 2,000-3,000 stars visible to the naked eye. It's fun. I've done this at giving shows. I know Dave Leake does it too, or the rest of the crew out at Parkland. They've got a You get the planetarium going, and then they've got a little light bulb that produces scattered light that replicates being in town. And you start it off that way, and everybody says, oh, isn't this nice? And you turn it off. You just hear the oohs and the ahs because that's the way it really looks. It's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So it's great if you ever have the opportunity to really get into a place where this sky is.
And it's not hard to do around here. You can drive 30 miles outside of town into the dark countryside, and it's a different world.
Hmm. It seems to me that, and I know there are places and a lot of people who are concerned with the issue of light pollution, and both because they think it'd be great to be able to see the sky, and actually because if you're concerned about the amount of energy that goes into lighting, you don't want to waste
it. The wastage is astonishing.
Yeah.
Even if you look around Champaign-Urbana, you've got these lights that scatter everything up. Now, there's no need to scatter light up in the air to illuminate trees and bird bellies and everything else. You want to put it on the ground, and you can cut your costs considerably by throwing it on the ground where it belongs. Nobody in this business wants to eliminate lighting. But you can do, for example, what Tucson, Arizona did. They put in a strict lighting ordinance because of Kitt Peak Observatory 50 miles away, and over the last 50 years, the sky at Kitt Peak hasn't brightened at all, while the city of Tucson has dramatically expanded. You can do it. You just put it down on the ground.
So you think that that maybe concerns about energy consumption will actually help to—
That'll probably do more than the longing for dark skies.
Yeah.
There is a story, and it may be apocryphal, that power failure in Los Angeles and lights went out and people saw stars for the first time and they got scared. Called the police department. What are that? What is that?
What is that?
That's probably not true, but it's a good story anyway.
Yeah. I also came across an article about the fact that I guess at the moment, or maybe not just at this moment, there is a lot of telescope building going on, and once again, astronomers all over the planet are talking about building new and bigger telescopes.
For a time, they've 200 inches completed in 1948, and the latter part, these telescopes are very expensive to build, and the technology sort of stalled for a while. But what happened was that there was a tremendous electronic revolution, which was started at the U of I Observatory here, by the way, around 1908-1909, of improving the efficiency of detectors. Photography is dreadfully inefficient. You're using about 2% of the light. The rest of it just gets thrown away. So it takes long exposures to do everything. It's a terrible medium to really work in. The electronic detectors of today, it's like the back ends of modern electronic cameras, except far more accurate, can have efficiencies up to close to 100%. So what used to take you a few hours of observing time will now take you a few minutes, if that. So you're effectively increasing the size of the telescope by increasing the efficiency of the detectors. Once you hit 100%, there isn't any place to go anymore, so you have to start building bigger and bigger telescopes. So that began to take place a couple of decades ago. And the 10-meter Keck, twin Keck instruments on top of Mauna Kea, the Japanese have an 8-meter. We got a couple of 8-meters, one in the northern hemisphere, one in the southern hemisphere. The Europeans got a set of 4 8-meters called the VLT, the Very Large Telescope, down there in the southern hemisphere. And some of the European groups now have they want to build the OWL telescope, the OWL, a 100-meter telescope. It's the Overwhelmingly Large Telescope, the OWL.
They need to be more creative with their names.
Well, I think the names are funny. It gets the point across.
Next is going to be the "you think yours was big, but this is a really big telescope" telescope. Our telescope is bigger than your telescope.
Well, when the Japanese made their 8-meter, they made it 8.2 meters, so it would be a little bit bigger than the 8 meters that were going up elsewhere.
We still do have this problem, though, with the atmosphere. And
to some degree, you can collect more.
One
of the major purposes of the Hubble Space Telescope, of course, was to get above the twinkling effect of the Earth's atmosphere, so you can make use of the resolving power of the telescope. But you also, of course, get the ultraviolet and the infrared, which you can't get down on the ground. You wouldn't want to get the ultraviolet down on the ground because that's where your sunburns come from. Modern mirror technology and computer technology has enabled telescopes to detwinkle starlight, because the twinkling effect that you see is not only a change in brightness, it's a slight shift in the position. It's caused by variable refraction in the Earth's atmosphere. So if the star shifts one way, if you do it fast enough, you can tilt your mirror in the opposite way and restabilize the image. And everybody is building telescopes now. They're called adaptive optics techniques, where you can almost get rid of the twinkling effects entirely. You still can't observe the ultraviolet infrared. You still need space telescopes. But we're getting close to being able to do on the ground what we are doing from space.
Well, that was getting at my next question. Does that really mean that being able to have a telescope on a platform that's above the atmosphere is not as important as—
Oh, it'll always be important because of the absorbing effects of the Earth's atmosphere. It's just that you can get rid of some of the effects on the ground using the adaptive optic techniques, and you're still not going to get perfection. You can still do better from above the Earth's atmosphere, especially with wide-angle imaging. On the ground, you have a problem with the twinkling in one direction. You look fraction of a degree away from it, the twinkling is a little different. So you're really restricted in your field of view using current adaptive optic techniques. That may change.
And I probably should have checked on this. Do you know what the latest is on Hubble? Are they now planning to do
something? Yeah, they're planning to redo it. We should be good through, I forget the date, 2012 or something like that, until well overlapping with the next generation Webb telescope, which will be considerably bigger, but it will not be serviceable. It'll be too far away from the Earth.
Uh-huh. What's the timeline on that, assuming, of course, that there's money
for it? I can't
remember.
2010, and that's kind of a guess. I simply can't recall. The money, I mean, is there. It's under construction.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to the point almost where we have to finish. I don't know if there's any last thing that you might
want
to...
Yeah, get out and take a look at Orion. Take a look at the winter stars. The moon is now it just passes third quarter. It's nice to get out in the evening. Look up and look to the south, and you can't miss this bright, beautiful seven-star figure. If you've got binoculars, look to the three stars in a row on the equator. They're the belt of Orion. Look down from it. You see another string of stars. Put your binoculars on it, and you can get a glimmer of the Orion Nebula. Yeah. With the simplest optical equipment, doesn't take much. Practically over your head is Gemini and Auriga, bright whole circle of bright constellations, and it's just a beautiful sight in this time of year.
Yeah.
Especially if the moon can get out of the way.
And he's moving, so one of these days he'll be
by April he'll be gone. You'll have to wait another year to pick him up.
All right. Well, I thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If people are interested in reading more about astronomy, you can head on to the bookstore or the library and look for some of Jim's books, The Little Book of Stars or The Greatest 100 Stars or his latest, The Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars. He's Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at University of Illinois. Yeah, I want to mention one more time this award because I think it's very cool. He has just awarded the American Astronomical Society's 2008 Education Prize, recognizing him for his contributions to the education of not only students, and the next generation of professional astronomers, but just plain folks like us here on the show. We appreciate you giving us your time.
Thank you very much.